Hi, Fawos University Times. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ray Kugel reporting. More deadly Israeli-Palestinian violence. An Arab armed with a gun and a knife attacked Israelis at the main bus station in Beersheba Sunday, killing one Israeli soldier and wounding 10 other people before police shot him dead. It was the bloodiest single incident in more than 2 weeks of Palestinian violence against Israelis, which has seen 8 Israelis and 41 Palestinians killed. Police started building a wall between one Jewish neighborhood and a Palestinian village in East Jerusalem to try to prevent more trouble. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry plans to meet separately this week with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. President Obama's ordered the U.S. government to begin preparing to lift sanctions against Iran on what was called Adoption Day, the day all parties who signed the nuclear deal in July take the first steps towards implementing it. Mr. Obama said Iran has also started carrying out its side of the deal, removing centrifuges, slashing its uranium stockpiles, and filling the Arak heavy water nuclear reactor with concrete, all to ensure it cannot build a nuclear weapon. The European Union also passed legislation Sunday, allowing its members to start looking at ending sanctions. Egyptian voters turned out in low numbers Sunday, the first phase of parliamentary elections widely expected to strengthen the President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi's grip on power. The long-delayed vote to fill the 596-member parliament will continue today in 14 provinces. Voting will continue November 22nd and 23rd elsewhere in the country. Egyptians living abroad began casting ballots Saturday. Final results, December. This is VOA News. Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel met with Turkey's Prime Minister in Istanbul to renew efforts for the country's stalled European Union membership. Dorian Jones reports.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel has been one of Ankara's staunchest opponents to membership, but at a news conference Sunday with Turkish Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu, she pledged support for its EU membership process. With Turkey a key transit route for migrants, Ankara's cooperation is seen as vital to the EU plan. Prime Minister Davutoğlu described the talks as positive. Our priority is to prevent illegal immigration and reduce the number of people crossing our borders. In that respect, we've had very fruitful discussions with the European Union recently, he said. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
Chancellor Merkel also offered Turkey an aid package of more than $3 billion to help host more than the 2 million refugees in the country. The Pentagon confirms the U.S.-led coalition airstrike killed a top al-Qaeda-linked militant in northwest Syria last week. Saudi national Sanafi al-Nasser was killed Thursday. He's described as a member of the so-called Khorasan group and a longtime jihadist who handled finances between donors and various al-Qaeda operations. Secretary of State John Kerry Sunday lobbied for the United States to be reelected to the board of the UN group UNESCO. He promised to work with Congress to resume U.S. contributions to the group, which were cut off in protest of the Palestinians being admitted as full members.
We're agreeing really on how the mandate of UNESCO, the mandate of the United Nations, has never been more in need of being applied and lived by. And never has our work, frankly, been more important than it is today. There's an urgency to it.
Secretary of State John Kerry. A slow-moving typhoon is blanketing the northern half of the Philippines. Forecasters predict the storm could dump 600 millimeters of rain over the next several days. Simone Orendain has more from Manila.
State forecaster Manny Mendoza says since Kopu is progressing at just 5 kilometers per hour, the Weather Service revised its expected exit from land to Thursday instead of Tuesday. Mendoza says heavy to intense rain will continue in bursts in the mountainous provinces on the north and north-central part of the Philippines' main island of Luzon. Forecasters say this is causing flash flooding and landslides. The winds have uprooted trees, knocked out power, and blown off lightweight rooftops. Simone Orendain, Manila.
Zambians took part in a National Day of Prayer Sunday to heal the country's ailing economy. It follows the collapse of the global copper price market. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbate in Washington. Today is Monday, October 19th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Egyptians voted Sunday in the first phase of parliamentary elections, but without the Muslim Brotherhood.
Most of the more than 5,000 parliamentary candidates support the current government, and many of the voters at this polling station say they came out to vote to support the president.
That's correspondent Heather Murdoch in Cairo. Guinea is a divided country this morning as President Conde is re-elected. It appears the long wait for Nigerian President Buhari's cabinet may be over this week. And the African Union threatened sanctions on certain individuals in Burundi, but the government says sanctions are counterproductive.
In our view, we believe, first of all, it is too early to talk about sanctions because sanctions do not resolve crisis. What is true to other countries, which have gone through even more serious issues than ourselves, should be true to Burundi.
Alain Nyamitwe is Burundi's foreign minister. Ivory Coast prepares to pay reparations to victims of the country's 2010 post-election violence. And Kenyan teenage mothers get second chance at education. Those stories plus Marco Oman's Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Egyptian voters turned out in low numbers on Sunday in the first phase of parliamentary elections that are widely expected to strengthen President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi's grip on power. Mr. el-Sisi has ruled Egypt since 2013 after the ouster of former President Mohamed Morsi. As Heather Murdoch reports from Cairo, Egypt has been without a parliament for 3 years.
Most of the more than 5,000 parliamentary candidates support the current government, and many of the voters at this polling station say they came out to vote to support the president. New lawmakers, they say, will help the president improve Egypt's ailing economy.
The country will be regulated and move into the future. It is very important to have a parliament.
Other voters say they hope the new lawmakers will take steps to create jobs and provide aid for the poor.
We want the country to be better and people to live comfortably. We need jobs for our young people.
But after 4 years of political turmoil, other Egyptians say they have little hope new lawmakers will do much to improve conditions.
The area smells like garbage and dirt, and streets are crowded by vendors. If our parliament really served us, would not they have served us in the past?
Egypt's last parliament was dissolved in 2012, and these election results are expected in early December. Some voters complained that when they were offered bribes outside the polls, they were offered only about $6 instead of more valuable items like oil and sugar that they've been offered in the past. Some Egyptians fear election irregularities could later be used to dissolve the new parliament. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Cairo.
Guinea's incumbent president, Alpha Condé, has won the country's second democratic election, but opposition parties have rejected the results and called for demonstrations. Chris Stein reports with Karim Kamara in Conakry, Guinea.
The head of Guinea's independent National Electoral Commission, Bakary Fofana, announced President Alpha Condé's re-election victory last Saturday. He says before the Constitutional Court's final validation of the results, the Electoral Commission proclaims Condé is the winner in the first round of voting held last Sunday. Before the results were announced, Guinea's main opposition leader and former Prime Minister, Selu Daline Diallo, announced he and the six other opposition candidates would reject them. The candidates last week claimed widespread fraud in the voting. International observers have said the vote was free and fair, but they did criticize the Electoral Commission for poorly organizing the elections, saying some people waited hours to cast ballots. In his statement, Diallo said he would not appeal the results in the Constitutional Court. He instead called for peaceful demonstrations. About 12 people died in violence in the run-up to the polls. The streets of the capital, Conakry, were calm Sunday. La Source University in Conakry professor Sori Jikate called for Diallo to seek recourse in the courts if he feels the vote was fraudulent. He said the same law that allows for him to march in the streets allows for him to file a complaint at the Constitutional Court. As for Condé, he has his work cut out for him, Jikate says. Despite being home to stores of valuable minerals like bauxite and iron ore, about half of Guineans live in poverty.
The people of Guinea have been waiting for a lot of their problems to be fixed, Jakate says. There is the problem of water and the problem of electricity, although he says there has been some improvements in that. He also cites the problem of unemployment. Candidates have 8 days to file complaints with the Constitutional Court before it certifies the results. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
Burundi's foreign minister says any mediation effort to resolve the country's political crisis should not involve any threat of sanctions, because sanctions do not resolve issues, but rather exacerbate them. On the other hand, Alain Nyamitwe said Burundi is ready to cooperate with the African Union's investigation on any alleged violations of human rights and other abuses against civilian populations in Burundi. This comes after the African Union Peace and Security Council meeting in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, decided over the weekend to impose targeted sanctions against Burundians who contribute to the perpetuation of violence, as well as impede the search for a solution to the crisis facing the country. Nyamitwe says President Pierre Nkurunziza's government has been trying to restore peace and stability to Burundi.
We are aware of that communique, and we have taken it very seriously, because we believe that some of the people who have vowed to fight against the government have been using violent means to achieve political goals, including targeted killings, and those have to be absolutely targeted. Now, if there is anybody within the government circles who might have also involved himself in such acts, it is also correct to think that they might also be targeted, if indeed a proper investigation brings to that conclusion.
So, Minister, you're suggesting that, as far as you are concerned, members of your government are not part of the stakeholders that the African Union is referring to?
No, I'm saying that as a government, what the government of the Republic of Burundi has been doing was to make sure that peace and security are kept and restored in the country. That's what every government would do. Now, should there be anybody, should be a rotten apple, if I may say, then, of course, that person would be, so to say, eligible to sanctions. That's the spirit of the community. That's how I see it. But in our view, we believe that, first of all, it is too early to talk about sanctions, because sanctions do not resolve crisis. If you look around in Africa, you not find one single crisis which has been resolved through sanctions. Even South Sudan itself, I remember in Peace and Security Council, we've been saying, let us not rush into sanctions, because this is a very fragile situation which might exacerbate in case we go the route of sanctions. What is true to South Sudan, what is true to other countries which have gone through even more serious issues than ourselves, should be true to Burundi.
When you talk to opposition people, they claim that the violence that's going on, which the African Union is concerned about, also is perpetrated by your security people.
Well, that remains to be confirmed by a proper investigation. If you have read carefully the communique of the Peace and Security Council, it has called for a proper investigation. And we are ready to cooperate with that investigation to make sure that everything is crystal clear, because impunity does not help any country, whether it is Burundi or any other country we could name.
Mr. Minister, following the election and the formation of your government, where are we in terms of reaching out to the opposition in the form of dialogue?
Thank you very much for the question. The African Union Peace and Security Council has called for an inclusive dialogue which allows opposition parties to take part, and it has even called for that dialogue to take place in another country outside Burundi. But I hasten to say two things. Number one is that the government is clearly open for dialogue with the opposition, because the government has established the National Commission for Inter-Burundian Dialogue, which will give the opportunity to every single Burundian who wishes to speak on current issues to do so. That includes also people from the opposition. As I speak, I had seen yesterday President Museveni and President Kenyatta of Kenya, who have also called for that dialogue to happen and have promised that we are going to make sure that all those people from the opposition who want to discuss with the government will be given that opportunity.
Alain Nyamitwe is Burundi's foreign minister. He was speaking with me from the capital, Bujumbura. Today is Monday, October 19th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Let's give a shout out to listeners on these our VOA affiliate stations: Buffalo FM in Monrovia, Liberia; Brela FM in Nigeria; Kisi FM in Tanzania; Capital FM in Blantyre, Malawi; and Kira FM in Jinja, Uganda. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. It appears the end may finally be near for Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari to complete the formation of his much-awaited cabinet nearly 5 months after he was sworn in. The Nigerian Senate is Tuesday and Wednesday this week expected to complete the final screening of 36 cabinet nominees. Garba Shehu, senior special assistant to the president of media and publicity, says the selection process has taken this long because President Buhari, unlike previous administrations, has high expectations of his cabinet. Shehu also said being a member of the Buhari government is not going to be business as usual.
From the work of the Senate on the screening, it's very clear that more than half of the cabinet members have themselves been cleared by now. So the balance of about 16, you know, to 18 who are awaiting clearance will hopefully go through the process between Tuesday and Wednesday. So yes, it is correct that we are closer to having a cabinet.
The president has been very slow on this process. Is he trying to be just careful, or he hasn't found the right people?
Are related to the ability or inability to get right candidates. Yes, he has raised the bar. President Buhari has a very high expectation of people who are coming to his own government. So it's not going to be business as usual. So yes, the bar is higher. But the main reason why all of this is trying to come together is on account of the fact that there is a rottenness in the way our manner government ministries have been run. Before now, it's been a free-for-all. In the area of government revenues, in many of the government departments, there was no difference between what belonged to government and what belonged to, you know, leaders of government departments. Government revenues are being traced to private accounts of individuals. The president would have made a mistake if he had announced ministers on day two of his administration and if he had continued to build on that rotten foundation. He needed to clean up the system. He needed to plug loopholes through which government revenues are stolen, and to ensure that when ministers come, they will be building on a foundation that is cogent, that is transparent, and that is strong and that will last. So it's nothing about the inability to get this account of 170 million people. You can get all manner of it, good and bad here. The issue is that he didn't want to build on the rotten foundation.
I don't know, maybe the president is trying to be very careful, as you said, but is it possible he can find people who are not going to be affected by previous activities or tainted, I mean?
Again, as I said to you, yes, he's interested in ensuring that only men and women of integrity are in his government. He has a very high standard in terms of moral conduct and personal character, especially for his stand against the corruption in the country. Yes, he would like men to come, but the preoccupation and the choice of is not about all of that. It's a factual. The issue, as I said earlier, is that we found that government was being run irregularly. Corruption was the order of the day, theft of government revenues, order of the day. The government departments didn't even know how many accounts they had. The president thought it was untenable to continue with business as usual. He needed to clean things up, plug loopholes before we start building on it.
Garba Shehu is the senior special assistant of media and publicity to President Muhammadu Buhari of Nigeria. You are speaking with me from Abuja, Nigeria. 5 years after the deadly 2010 post-election violence in Ivory Coast, the country is determined to consolidate its peace and reconciliation. To help make this possible, President Alassane Ouattara created agencies aimed at providing reparation for war victims. The first batch of victims was compensated last August, but as Emily Yap reports, many war victims are still waiting and some are losing patience over what they say is a lagging process.
24 years old Samate Abdullahi is a survivor. He was shot in the head during the post-election violence in Ivory Coast in 2010. His father was killed while out trying to gather money for his son's operation. The family has been struggling to make ends meet ever since. Abdoulaye has lifelong after effects from his war injuries, which prevent him from doing hard physical work to help out his mother and two younger siblings. He is currently studying for an office job.
If I have this compensation fund, I will invest it, and it will give me some peace of mind. I will be able to pursue my studies, knowing that my family has something to fall back on financially.
Ivory Coast government has pledged to compensate the victims of the country's various crises between 1990 and 2012. Free health care for injured people, scholarship for war orphans, and cash payment for the families of those killed during the war. But most of the victims still have not received anything, and they are getting impatient. Earlier this month, some of them protested in front of the CONARIB, the government agency in charge of listing all victims entitled to compensation. They were pressing the agency to finally release the list of victims and for war children to have free education.
CONARIB has identified the victims and told us the total from various lists is 130,000 victims. They told us that now they need to verify it and give a definitive list to the president of Ivory Coast so he can validate it, and the victims can't start receiving payment. But since it was created, the CONARIB hasn't been able to produce this list.
The CONARIB was created recently to finish the job of another agency whose list was deemed incomplete after 3 years of work. Commissioner Françoise Kodjis Ofumu says there are many challenges to pulling together a definitive list.
There are victims in isolated areas who couldn't be identified. It's for them that we're extending the delay to register.
Kodjis also says the verification process takes time, with teams cross-referencing data on computers, via phone calls, or, when necessary, in the field. There is some progress on the payment front. Last August, 4,500 victims of the 2010-2011 post-election violence received payments. Aya Kwadio was one of them. Both her husband and his brother were killed, leaving two wives and 17 children behind. When Kwadio received the money, she divided it among all the children. Now she would like the government to help her children get an education so they can find jobs.
Before school starts, they should say, here are the children of the crisis, here are their cases. Here is what we'll do to help them. We shouldn't have to do sit-ins or cry to people. We're tired of begging.
Kwadio adds that she's hopeful that getting some kind of compensation is a good first sign that the reparation process is going in the right direction. Emily Yob for VOA News in Abidjan.
Rates of teenage pregnancy are high in Kenya, where a recent government survey found that 18% of women aged 15 to 19 have either given birth or are pregnant with their first child. Lenny Ruvaga reports from Nyeri on an initiative that is giving teen mothers a second chance to complete their education.
Early morning in Nyeri, 100 kilometers from Kenya's capital, Nairobi. Today, 17-year-old Cynthia Wairimu makes her way to class. She is in her final year of primary school and will take her final exams in December. She gave birth to her daughter Eunice last month.
My hopes are to determine my future and to achieve my goals so that I can be a better person and be more serious in my studies and improve so that I can be respectable later.
Cynthia is part of the Pick Me Up program that has helped more than 100 teen mothers finish school since it started in Kenya 2 years ago. The government and the United Nations say that every year, 13,000 girls leave school early in Kenya due to pregnancy. Lack of education and little or no access to contraception drive the high rate of teen pregnancy. Hawa Wangeshi mentors 20 teen mothers, many of whom face stigma and poverty.
Getting the teen mothers is the biggest challenge since they're afraid to come out and seek help and counsel to go back to school. Secondly, they're poor and getting resources to get back into school is difficult.
Pick Me Up is funded by members who contribute $10 a month.
The government has not yet introduced sex education in schools, so this initiative is meant to empower the girl child, the school-going girl child, so that we can be able to fill in the gaps and make this world a better place to live in.
Finishing school increases a girl's future earning potential, which can mean a better life for both her and her child. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nyeri, Kenya.
It's 25 minutes past the hour time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Marco Uma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak African Sports News, we begin with the football. Zimbabwe and South Africa have qualified to represent Africa in women's football at the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Olympics in Brazil. South Africa edged their hosts Equatorial Guinea 1-0 in Bata on Sunday in the return leg of their qualifier to carry the day on a 1-0 aggregate. Hosts Zimbabwe pipped Cameroon 1-0 in Harare on Sunday. With the two sides deadlocked at 2-2 on aggregate, Zimbabwe prevailed on their away goal advantage. In Chile, Mali and Belgium drew 0-0 in Talca at the FIFA Under 17 World Cup on Sunday. Earlier on Saturday, Guinea and England drew 1-1, while defending champions Nigeria dismissed the United States of America 2-0 in the Chilean capital, Santiago. Today, Monday, South Africa play Costa Rica in Concepcion. Elsewhere, hosts Swaziland edged Djibouti 2-1 in the return leg of their Africa preliminary 2018 FIFA World Cup qualifier in Lobambo on Saturday. Swaziland prevailed with an 8-1 aggregate. Meanwhile, hosts Zimbabwe beat Lesotho 3-1 in Bulawayo as Gabon surprised their hosts Chad 2-0 in N'Djamena in African Nations Championship qualifiers on Sunday. Ghana pipped Ivory Coast 2-1 and Guinea beat Senegal 2-0 in Bamako, Mali. Earlier on Saturday, Nigeria dismissed visitors Burkina Faso 2-0 in Port Harcourt, Rivers State. Burundi beat Ethiopia 2-0. Zambia outwitted Mozambique 3-0. Mali pipped Mauritania 2-1. Uganda outplayed Sudan 2-0. Cameroon and the Republic of Congo drew 0-0 as Niger beat Togo 2-0. Today, Monday, defending champions Libya tackle Tunisia in Tunis. In athletics, Kenyans Bernard Kipyegon and Joyce Chepkurui triumphed in the men's and women's races at the TCS Amsterdam Marathon in the Netherlands on Sunday. Kipyegon retained his title with a winning time of 2 hours 6 minutes and 19 seconds as Chepkurui completed the women's race in 2 hours 24 minutes and 11 seconds. In cricket, Uganda bounced back to beat Papua New Guinea by 9 wickets at the ICC Under-19 Cricket World Cup qualifier in Kinara, Malaysia on Sunday. Early on Saturday, they lost by 171 runs to Nepal, and on Friday they fell by 6 wickets to the United States of America. Today, Monday, Uganda play Ireland in their last round-robin encounter. Finally, South Africa fought hard to come from behind to edge Wales 23-19 in a Rugby World Cup quarterfinals played in London, England on Saturday. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Here's our listener mail for this Monday morning, October 19th.
Good morning, Daybreak Africa. As Nigerians are widely accepted President Muhammad Buhari anti-draft war, I want to call on the extension of the war to the state and local government joint account system in the country, because the purpose for which local government allocation from the federation account is meant for is no longer visible as envisaged by law. Albert Alagbo, former Canadian Federal Polytechnic in Ebonyi State, Nigeria. Thank you.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. That is it for this Monday, October 19th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Mark Oman, along with our engineer John Ellison, I'm James Butte in Washington, hoping you make this week a very productive one.
Next on Straight Talk Africa. Host Shaka Sali and his guests will discuss the upcoming elections in Africa and consider what makes an election credible to the extent that it reflects the will of the people. That's Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on VOA Africa. Next on Let's Talk. Turncoat, According to the dictionary, the word turncoat means a person who stops being a member of one group in order to join another group that opposes the first group. Do you want to know more? Join host Sandy Shomari and his guests discussing Turncoat. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.